Eyes. Hear ye, hear ye. This Honorable Appellate Court for the 2nd Judicial District is now back in session. The Honorable Susan F. Hutchinson presiding.
And please be seated.
Your Honor, the final case on the docket this afternoon is 2-22-0380. Janet Olson and Scott Olson, plaintiff's appellants, lead the Center for Foot and Ankle Surgery, LTD, doing business as Foot and Ankle Centers, an Illinois corporation, Paul Bishop, PCN, Sanders, Appellees. Arguing on behalf of the appellant, Mr. James Karamanis. Also arguing on behalf of the appellant, Mr. Kenneth A. Mazzaro. Arguing on behalf of the appellees, Ms. Amy K. Lippitz.
Okay. All right, good afternoon, and again, I've been apologizing all morning. When your first one goes long, it just seems like the rest of the day is lost, so we do apologize for being late. And we are now, though, ready to proceed. And is it Mr. Karamanis who's going to come first?
Karamanis.
Okay, sorry. Can't read my own writing.
Thank you.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is James Karamanis. We represent the plaintiff appellant here. One phone call, one text, one email pursuant to 201K, and we would not be before your honors right now. We would likely have had this case tried and would have been completed. Essentially, there is a bit of a tortured expert history in this case. We had a certifying expert who was not available to participate in the case. Then we hired Dr. Goldman, who issued certain opinions. Counsel filed a motion because we were barred from the 2011 surgery. This case came to us after the statute of limitations. So it's not as though it was there at one point and it wasn't. Any standard of care opinions relating to the 2011 surgery were stricken. We believed, and we have a duty to our client, to try and preserve issues of a continuous course of treatment because she received the surgery in 2011 and the surgery in 2013. So when we redisclosed our opinions, we had the opinions there in total, but we had stricken certain language. Now, based on Dr. Goldman's perception that the 2011 surgery was also negligent, we, at that point, filed a motion for reconsideration on the issue of a continuous course of treatment, and then proceeded to an appeal on this court. We did not provide new opinions with that stricken information removed because there is case law regarding appeals that if you file, for example, an amended complaint and you take out certain provisions, you waive that argument on appeal. So instead, we struck the language with a line through. So So when we finally got to the point where it was time to depose Dr. Goldman, he had taken a different position, and this was in early December. The year escapes me at this point, but we tried.
Excuse me, early December of what?
I'm sorry?
Early December of what?
I believe.
Or ballpark.
I think it was, you know.
Before or after the appeal?
With COVID. It was after the appeal. Okay, so. And there was no dispute with respect to Dr. Goldman's opinions. Okay, we were ready. We were basically just going to go and have his deposition. But when he gave us the notice that by the end of January that he would not be able to participate, we tried, sent numerous emails to counsel to have his discovery deposition taken so we could take his evidence deposition, preserve it for trial so that we could, so that we would not have to hire another expert. We brought this issue up before the judge, the trial court, and the judge said, you're just going to have to find another expert. So that's what we did. So we found another expert, Dr. Havel, and he, and we gave explicit direction to Dr. Havel, the 2011 surgery is not an issue in this case. His opinions, however, and it's the same issue with Dr. Goldman, is that based on the knowledge that Dr. Bishop, defendant Dr. Bishop, acquired in the first surgery, that his actions in the second surgery were breach the standard of care. So you, and that was the subject of a motion to reconsider on our part back when we were talking, when we were going to take Dr. Bishop's deposition to be able to inquire into what he knew from that first surgery. Just because we're asking what he knew in that first surgery does not mean that we were looking to make standard of care allegations against Dr. Bishop, defendant Dr. Bishop, on that point. It was because you can't just look at the 2013 surgery in a vacuum without the knowledge that he acquired, because he opened the foot up and he saw what was in there, and he put an implant in, and based on what he knew from the first surgery, the failure for the first surgery, he should not have done what he did in the second surgery.
Well, in the second surgery, I seem to recall a reading that it was the same implement that he used. Was that the extent of what you were going to ask, or was there more than that?
That's essentially our argument. He should have chosen a fusion surgery. Should not have placed the same implant when the first implant failed.
Okay.
So that's the crux of our argument. But we have to be able to go into the facts of the first surgery, because we have to impute that knowledge to him, because once he has that knowledge, then he shouldn't have done the second surgery. Okay. So the way he did it.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
You said, well, after the appeal, that Dr. Goldman was going to be unavailable and you had to get Dr. Harrell. And you also said we wanted to preserve issues concerning,
okay.
Once the appeal had occurred, at that point, what was there to preserve?
So
I guess my question is, I didn't want to interrupt your flow, so go, you know, right back to where you were.
No, and that's
but
probably...
ultimately, you know, I want to know is why this persistence to include in your F3 interrogatory answers criticisms, whether they're implied or explicit, when the trial court had barred it, clearly.
I can explain that exactly. That's
although I had one last thing.
Okay.
It was clear to me, and again, it's a voluminous and complex record, so you guys know it better. But Judge Schreiber and Judge Bowles, it seemed to me, both said at different times, of course you will need to touch upon the facts of what occurred in 2011. So why the need to persist in these disclosures that had been barred? I guess ultimately that's going to be my issue, as long as I'll tack on one other question. What was the judge to have done? Because if the standard of review is abuse of discretion, and if it had been ordered repeatedly and brought up repeatedly that the F3s keep containing these, you know, implications concerning the 2011 surgery, requiring the defense to come in, move to strike, trial court has to hear these things, what was she to do? What would have been a better thing for her to do than just strike it all?
Let me answer your last question first. The better thing for her to do was basically just enforce the barring order. If any of the language in Dr. Havel's disclosures touched upon it. Sequentially, I want to make this perfectly clear. We included stricken language in Dr. Goldman's disclosures for purposes of preserving those issues for appeal. Those were criticisms of the
certain. I don't recollect seeing that this was indicated for the purposes of review, or it's just in there, mixed in with everything that, you know, he criticizes the 2011 surgery because as it was the wrong option for this lady's anatomy in 2011, it remained the wrong option, and maybe even with stronger force, in the 2013 surgery. It's not in, I think I've got the right document. It's not in there that, oh, we just want to preserve this. It's all mushed in there such that the defense would have to parse it out and the trial court parse it out. And I understand it could have been done, but I think their contention is, and I think the trial court made clear, this had been done before. So I
can absolutely address that. First of all, the language was stricken. There were lines through the language that was ruled upon. We filed an appeal on that language, continuous course of treatment, and we lost. Dr. Goldman's opinion did not contain that language. So we're not criticizing the 2011 surgery. Dr. Harrell's opinions do not criticize the 2011 surgery. Okay, they're there for reference. But there is but the bottom line is this all could have been resolved through a 201K conference, which is required by the rules. We were not seeking to shoehorn criticism for the 2011 surgery. We cannot talk about the 2013 surgery without the knowledge of the 2011 surgery. Now, if you just look at the disclosures, which is on our page 11, what could she have done? She could have struck in, our paragraph 5 is quite clear. Dr. Harrell will likely opine that Dr. Bishop breached the standard of care during the 2013 surgery of Janet Olson by performing another first metatarsal phalangeal joint arthroplasty. There's no ambiguity there. So why, if you look at paragraph 3, Dr. Harrell will discuss the subsequent decision of implant removal and replacement with the same.
I see those.
Yeah, so if there's an issue with the other one, strike them. If counsel had an issue with some of the phraseology, just remember, if we were deliberately trying to shoehorn this information, there were no problems with Dr. Goldman's opinion. I mean, these are experts that we hire. They file reports. We told this doctor, only look at the 2013 surgery. The rule, the 201K is there for a reason. It's a discovery tool. If they would have called us, if they would have reached out, we would say, certainly, we're not interested.
And again, just because it's kind of on my mind.
Okay.
And I'm not, you know, trying to cross-examine you.
Feel free. I mean,
but there was that exchange in some correspondence and email in August of, is it 2020?
Okay.
Wait. Where, I believe it was related to the third amended complaint. Now I'm going to shuffle through my papers, and I've never even looked for a judge. But in the emails, you proposed, you had strikeouts to your F3 disclosures. And I think you said, or someone from your firm, I think it was you, we don't want to get balled up on content. So what do you think of this? And they came back and said, well, look, with specific subparagraphs. And your response was not, oh, we're just trying to preserve, you know, we're not going to, it was just what's wrong with that, and or something to that effect. And if I had it in front of me, I would be more explicit and fair. But, you know, it wasn't we're trying to preserve this review. It was like, what's wrong with it? And there were clearly some perhaps were not clear criticisms of the 2011 surgery. Others were more arguably criticisms of the 2011 surgery, which would require the defense to parse out, you know, what's going to come in, what will his opinions be, and the trial court to take up its time. So I guess concerning the 201K, I do see that previous exchange is relevant. Do you?
And I'm glad you brought that correspondence up. Does that show an unwillingness on our part to work with counsel to try and come to some kind of conclusion with a discovery dispute, which is what this is? The court, it was quite clearly ruled that we cannot have standard of care opinions for the 2011 surgery. That's quite clear. And we weren't planning on that. We weren't planning on having Dr. Harrell testify to that. As a matter of fact, he was instructed specifically that that's not the issue. So in trials, if some matter is attempted to be brought up, I mean, there's a previous ruling, then sanctions are appropriate at that point. What could the judge have done? The judge could have struck any paragraph that she believes was ambiguous. I mean, the language here wasn't meant to say there's nowhere it says there's a breach of standard of care in the 2011 surgery. It's basically based on the 2011 surgery. He shouldn't have done what he did in 2013. So, and the fact is, even if...
Had not the trial court done that in, December of 2020?
Correct. And we struck that. And
to Judge Schreiber.
Right. And we struck
his previous motion prior.
Right. But we struck that language. And the 2020 disclosures are not at issue now.
Well, you struck the language that said the first surgery. And then you struck language that said 2011 at some point in time. But you were still referred where you said another. He should not have done, I think you just read, another.
Correct.
Well, that implies there was a previous surgery that
correct.
Apparently we weren't supposed to talk about.
No, we can talk about the previous surgery. I went in on a motion before we took defendant Dr. Bishop's deposition, and we were allowed to inquire into the first surgery because the knowledge he acquired in the first surgery is relevant to his choices in the second surgery. And I think that fact is escaped here. So,
as long as we're close to that, I did want to point out, I think it was July 29 of 2020,
okay,
where the trial court says, you know, no opinions of negligence and damages, which, you know, of course, mm-hmm, that was fine. And I don't even hear you disputing that, but she goes on, as well as criticism, suggestions of negligence, insinuation, and or innuendo not rising to the level of a deviation from the standard of care of anything prior to 5/15/13. And But once she said that, I mean, how hard is it to just comply?
Well, that's what we believe we did comply with. And if there's some language that's ambiguous here, again, these are our experts' disclosures. If there's some language that is somehow ambiguous, isn't that the purpose of Rule 201K? To say, look, this is, you're touching upon, I mean, you've read correspondence of our willingness to work with counsel to resolve discovery disputes. We know there's a barring order. I mean, I just didn't start doing trials yesterday. So we know there's a barring order. There was no chance that we were going to introduce evidence of negligence. The only evidence that we were going to introduce, and we tried to frame these disclosures of Dr. Harrell in that manner, is that essentially, based on what he learned in his first surgery, the 2013 surgery was negligent, period. But we cannot... You know, to the extent that any of this language touches upon innuendo, we certainly wouldn't be allowed to testify about that on trial. The resolution is not to bar the expert in his totality and basically have the case thrown out because we now cannot present an expert. That is not the appropriate solution here. I mean, I feel like we were essentially punished because we tried to protect the client's cause of action for a continuous course of treatment with Dr. Goldman's opinions that we just learned about then, okay? And when we lost that appeal, that issue was dead. But we had Dr. Goldman, who we were fervently trying to get his deposition done and his evidence deposition done, and defendants would not comply with scheduling dates. We had almost 2 months before he started his new job at the end of January. We had almost 2 months where we could have taken his discovery deposition and taken his evidence deposition. We even brought that up to the court, and the court said, no. We were not looking, and there was no issue with Dr. Goldman's opinions. All right, there's no motion there. So why would we try and come back? It doesn't make any logical sense. That's the whole point of 201K. You know, essentially, a phone call to me would have said, okay, what's the problem? Let's get rid of it.
Okay, Mr. Karamanis, we have to let your colleague over at the table get his time in, too.
Okay.
So you'll have a chance to come back.
I think you're the one coming.
I can't remember who's coming back. One of you will come back later if you choose.
Okay. All right.
And Mr. Nazarene?
Yes, Your Honors. Thank you, Counsel. Obviously, we've gone a little over time. Will you allow me to speak on behalf of my client?
Yes.
Right. Your Honors, I'm here today because, first and foremost, I was at the court's decision. I believe that my experience in front of Judge Bowles at that moment can speak to three major issues. First being that I tried to demonstrate our willingness to try to comply with whatever the court had problems with our F3 disclosures. I tried to make it very clear to Judge Bowles that as counsel stated, a simple 201K would have resolved the issue. Now, the main thrust of what I'm here to argue before you, Your Honors, is that the severity of the sanction in this case is disproportionate for what occurred. Because of our willingness, we were trying to comply. As Mr. Karamanis stated, we were trying to move forward with this case. It would have given us no pleasure to delay this case any further than it had to be. We came to the table, and we were hoping to get this case resolved through Dr. Goldman and then Dr. Harrell. The case law, both in precedent in Szymanowski, we believe that that case is instructive here because the Supreme Court has instituted a mandate that 219C sanctions are inappropriate where there would be a result in dismissal, especially where there has been no blatant disregard, no contumacious disregard for the court's orders. In this case, not only did Judge Bowles sanction our clients and deny their ability to proceed with their case, there leading to summary judgment, but also she sanctioned our clients $7,000 in costs. We believe that the summary judgment was inappropriate because we believe the sanction was so severe in this case that it is inopposite to the law.
Well, counsel, this did not occur with your first witness. This was the third witness that had been on the scene. You know, there is a reference to a first expert and why he or she was no longer available isn't an issue. We now know why Dr. Goldman wasn't. But each time you go out and look for that person, maybe through no fault of your own, it takes time. And then you have to develop the actual opinion or have the doctor do it. And then you have to edit it so that you're not doing anything inconsistent with what the court said. And I think it appeared that the judge did not think maybe a 201K was going to work because so much time had already gone by.
And I'll address that specifically, Your Honor. In this case, the timing of our third expert was sudden. Obviously, we had become aware that Dr. Goldman was taking a position that would prevent him from testifying because of a conflict that existed. So we attempted to get his deposition. Our time was taken to get that deposition. I believe it was sometime in January we went before the court and we presented to the court the set of facts, that we were attempting to get Dr. Golden's deposition, that we were attempting to get an evidence deposition, and that we were attempting to resolve it with defense counsel. The trial court then responded by telling us, sounds like you need another expert counsel. We were given a short schedule. I believe we were only given 28 days to find a new expert and do those subsequent opinions, which we filed those in a timely fashion. We were able to get a new expert. We were able to get those opinions. That being said, after we got those opinions, we did not hear from defense counsel until we saw that motion to dismiss. Had we known, it is, I believe, replete with the record that we were attempting to adhere to our client's best interests throughout the course of this case. We were trying to avail ourselves of the options of the court and taking that appeal. We lost. We understand that. We understood our obligations. We understood our assignments. And we tried to craft the opinions to the best of our ability to avoid any problems. What we got in response was a motion to dismiss suddenly. We took it to the court and said, Judge, we could have resolved this. We would do virtually anything to make sure that the opinions are sufficient so that this case could go to trial. The court then dismissed that complaint, or dismissed our expert, struck the opinions, and denied my client from getting a new expert or presenting any expert, which ultimately led to summary judgment. The summary judgment in this case, we believe, was inappropriate because of the severity of the sanction. We don't believe that the effective dismissal of my client's case through the barring order was appropriate given the history. We don't believe that it was appropriate to then award a monetary sanction on top of a barring order that got rid of everything. Now, I believe Justice Mullen asked my co-counsel previously what could have been done. What could have been done? We, as lawyers, knew our obligations. We were aware of the obligations set by this court and by the prior judges. We tried to craft those responses, albeit, if your honors look at those responses and say they could have been crafted differently or could have been crafted better, that is, we are here today because of that. That being said, that does not show an unwillingness of our client or us to try to alter those opinions, nor does it show and warrant both a barring order and a monetary sanction on top of a dismissal of the case. We believe that the trial court grossly abused her discretion, its discretion, in this case, because of the fact that throughout the case, we availed ourselves of the operations of the court. That did take time. We acknowledge that. It did take time, as do all of these things. Here, we have a barring order that was entered shortly after we were given leave to issue new opinions. We moved expeditiously to get a new expert in that situation. And Justice Hutchinson, I believe, touched on the fact that this does take time, and I will acknowledge that throughout the case there were delays that were caused through those experts. But what it doesn't show is some contumacious disregard for the court's orders, something that is so egregious, something that in many of the cases that were cited by defense counsel illustrates a client or a party not appearing for deposition, deliberately, willfully not coming to depositions, refusing to tender medical records, refusing to do something in discovery that would promote compliance. Here we have compliance that is not being sought by the court. It was not, we were not sanctioned previously to have any specific, it wasn't as though Judge Bowles had issued some monetary sanction. I see my timing has elapsed. May I continue?
Finish your thought.
It was not as though Judge Bowles had instituted some monetary sanction or issued some lesser sanction to plaintiff to ensure compliance in these regards. It was a sudden, severe sanction that barred her and her husband from continuing on her case, effectively a dismissal, which we believe is in opposite to the Szymanowski decision. We also believe that the third district decision, and I believe Besko, would be instructive in this case since it involved a very similar set of facts, though legal malpractice instead of medical malpractice.
Well, speaking of, I guess it's Szymanowski, I'm not doing well with names this afternoon. There are six basic factors, and you've identified them, but did you actually apply them to this particular case in your argument?
Interestingly enough, Your Honor, I think that question is better suited for the trial court. I don't believe the trial court did. I believe that in this case, you have to look at those factors, which I realize is at my table at this point. That being said, those factors, I believe, swayed heavily towards the plaintiff. You have the surprise to defendant, which I don't believe was really a surprise here. There were issues that they brought up in their motion to dismiss. They clarified it very easily. There was no trial date set in this case. They could have very easily asked us to clarify. We were very willing to clarify any opinions that they had. So given those facts, there's no surprise and virtually no prejudice to defendants except for some additional time drafting a motion to dismiss, which we believe would have been obviated had they just contacted us and had they moved to try to seek some sort of compliance or change. We believe that generally in this case, we were not ever essentially admonished by the court and instituted a sanction, a discovery sanction for what we were moving forward. Opinions were stricken. We took that on appeal. It was within our rights and within my client's rights to have that appellate process. If we are being punished and being punitive because we took that appeal, I believe that is inappropriate and an abuse of discretion, especially here where in the court's own ruling cited to the appellate decision, cited to the fact that it's taken a long time because of the appeal. I think Your Honors should only be able to view that as a punitive decision against my client for taking an appeal from the prior orders.
Well, I can understand your argument in that regard, certainly. But remember, we're dealing with an abuse of discretion standard here. And it's also, I think, possible to characterize the trial court's rationale as taking into account the very lengthy time this case had pended. And Judge Schreiber barred in September of 2016. And if my timeline is accurate, and again, you guys know the record better, but in July of 2020, there's a motion to strike and bar on the same issue. Granted, let me just spit it all out, and then I want to make sure I don't. And there's certainly discussion. Let me go back to November 2 of 2017, where I think that was Judge Schreiber. He says, look, it's certainly there's going to be some limited questions, because this was an issue throughout the litigation, one way or another. But just to continue on the ways in which it was an issue, there was a motion to bar as sanctions after those emails in August of 2020. September 4 of 2020 was the motion, I think. That was denied. And then we have the appeal, and, you know, there, and again, the rationale that we want to include this because, you know, we want to preserve the client's rights. But after it had been brought up this time and that time and another time, and then you appeal and you lost all that, why come back at all? Again, leaving aside the argument, I hear your argument, this was too harsh a response, but why?
May I respond, Your Honor? Your Honor, I think that ultimately...
I do see the final F3s do, you know, as I say, they mix in and often are at least nonspecific, and sometimes they're just plain critical of what happened in 2011. Why?
Your Honor, I will be perfectly straightforward in this moment with you regarding those opinions. In those opinions, it was definitely not our intention to do that. Any type of... inference or any type of criticism directly related to the 2011 surgery, if viewed in that, was inadvertent. We did not intend to do that. We did not mean to do that. It was not our intention. I specifically spoke with Dr. Harrell, and I, before he rendered his opinions, told him explicitly, the 2011 surgery is not at issue. You may not opine on anything regarding that negligence. That was explicit in the disclosures, if they were inartfully drafted, as you implied. I believe that that was inadvertent, but not contemptuous. Contumacious. Keep switching the words
right. One of the statements in Dr. Harrell's expert report is that she had the surgery by Dr. Bishop, and then there was ongoing nerve, foot, and nerve pain and limitations in activity. This is the result of negligence that occurred during the course of her medical treatment. The course of her medical treatment includes 2011.
I cannot speak to Dr. Harrell's statement with regard to in the course of her medical treatment. My reading of that when the report came out, and I believe my partner's reading of it, was that it was in the course of her medical treatment since she was treated with Dr. Bishop beyond May of 2013 and onward.
It could have said that.
It could have. You're correct, Your Honor. And that is one of the reasons why we mentioned in our response to counsel's argument they have not even taken Dr. Harrell's deposition. We don't have a clear indication of the meaning behind his statements. I know we have our 213 obligations, and we tried to comply with those, Your Honors. But in this case, as Justice Mullen had pointed out, this is an abuse of discretion standard, and we have to look at what was actually being done, whether or not this was merely inadvertent, whether or not there shows some sort of unreasonable disregard for the court's orders that is so blatant and so contrary to the laws of Illinois that it would warrant dismissal. And we do not believe that those in this case warrant such a severe sanction. We believe that there are ample avenues that the court could have taken in this. And to answer further your question, Justice Mullen, I believe you spoke about it being an issue back from Judges Schneider, I believe was his name. I was not involved at that point, but I can say that at the time, the expert that we had gotten originally had indicated there was no negligence as part of the 2011 surgery. So we had proceeded on the assumption that there was no such negligence, and we did not push that in the case. We inquired about it at deposition. Counsel obviously had taken issue with some of our questions regarding that, but that was not our intent. So throughout the case, there was no intention of pushing that 2011 surgery. It wasn't until we retained Dr. Goldman, who indicated there was a possibility that this 2011 surgery was at issue, which is why at that point we felt we had an obligation to our client to address it with the appellate court, to ask the court to reconsider its position. Again, the appeal was granted. It was gone. We then had an unforeseen conflict that arose during the pendency of the appeal, which we had to shuffle and very quickly get a new expert and new disclosures out. Given that timing, given that speed in which we developed those, found a new expert, got those new disclosures, and then presented it and tried to get a deposition out of this new expert, only to be met with a motion to dismiss and a barring order, we cannot see that that is in the spirit of the laws of Illinois and the past precedent of both the Supreme Court and the other district courts surrounding.
Mr. Nazarin, hold on. I'm going to see if Justice Kennedy has any questions or Justice Mullen anything else right now. All right. One of you will come back if you choose after counsel proceeds.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
May it please the court, counsel. Plaintiff for the first time claims that what they've included as far as the continuous course of treatment, as far as Dr. Harrell's opinion, was inadvertent. For the first time today, that's the position that they've taken. They have never once addressed anything relative to Dr. Harrell's expert report other than to say that it didn't reference 2011, that those words were not included anywhere in that expert report. And in fact, plaintiff actually told the trial court in their response brief that defendants had fabricated and manufactured The allegations concerning the 2011 allegations of negligence, because they didn't exist in plaintiff's expert report. So now plaintiff is telling you that there was an inadvertence by them to include, or for their expert to include in his report, statements concerning a continuous course of treatment, which plaintiff has never addressed during the trial court arguments or even during the appellate court briefings. The only thing plaintiff has addressed was 2011 was never mentioned or referenced. Plaintiffs have repeatedly indicated that they did nothing wrong with their disclosures. That's the point of view that plaintiffs were presenting to the trial court, leading to the trial court's decision-making in this matter. Plaintiffs never offered to revise their expert disclosures after 4 years of noncompliance.
Well, there was some communication that Justice Mullen referred to where they did some strikeouts, and I don't know if the communication was to you directly or one of your colleagues. That looked like an effort to make some changes.
So in July of 2020, when plaintiffs had filed the expert disclosure, which completely violated the 2016 barring order, and defendants then filed a motion to strike, only then did plaintiffs file a motion to reconsider, which was completely improper because it brought up a new legal theory, which was relation back doctrine.
Well, the appellate court took care of all that.
And the appellate court took care of all of that, but in the middle of all of this, before it got to the appellate court, the court had ordered plaintiff to amend their expert disclosures to comport with her July ruling, striking and barring the expert disclosures that had all of this 2011 care and treatment and all of the care and treatment in between the two surgeries. And plaintiff sent over the expert disclosures, and we responded and told them these violate the 2016 order and the 2020 order. We wrote everything out in writing as to how it was violative. They did nothing. It wasn't a strikeout that they were preserving. They'd already used the strike through to preserve those arguments that they wished to preserve. We were indicating that there's new arguments that are still in their 213 disclosures that are not being preserved for appeal purposes by way of the strike through analysis, but instead they are just refusing to remove it because they feel it doesn't violate the 2016 and 2020 orders.
Was it ever, during the course of these conversations, was it ever proposed that either Dr. Goldman or Dr. Harrell could not limit, that they could not limit in their professional capacity the problems to just 2013, and there had to be some reference to a previous treatment?
I have no problem with the fact that the 2011 previous treatment was going to be discussed. I needed to discuss it too, but it's not negligent. My client offered plaintiff the option of a fusion that plaintiff is including in their amended disclosure. He offered the plaintiff the option of a fusion, and she declined. It's in his records. I need to put that evidence in. I have no problem with 2011, the fact that a surgery was performed coming in, but that's not what plaintiff does in these expert disclosures. And it's not just the expert disclosures by plaintiff's counsel, which include, by the way, in his expert disclosure in 2022, that it is anticipated Dr. Harrell will discuss the standard of care applicable.
Which paragraph?
This is their plaintiff's expert disclosure, the opinion. It's not the report by Dr. Harrell. It's actually plaintiff's attorneys. Excuse me, I think I was saying expert. Plaintiff's attorneys, Rule 213 F3 opinion.
Which paragraph?
It is the fifth paragraph down under opinions, under section I.
Is this the last?
No, that's not what she's looking at.
Okay. I am looking at the last F3 disclosure, but I'm not looking at Dr. Harrell's expert report that he, in fact, signed. What I'm looking at is plaintiff's actual expert disclosures of Harrell's opinions.
Little I. Yes.
I'm looking, it says, it is anticipated that Dr. Harrell will discuss the standard of care applicable to the care for a podiatrist performing the same or similar procedures that Janet Olson underwent.
Anything objectionable about that?
same or similar procedures. He's going to discuss the standard of care for two procedures.
Oh, the 2011. So you see that as encompassing the 2011.
So the use of the plural there that you're saying. So, okay, so are there other opinions that specifically reference?
Yes.
Go ahead.
If I may.
Yeah.
If we continue through the expert disclosures, paragraph 1, pursuant to Harrell's review that the information related to the above captioned matter, Dr. Harrell has come to the conclusion that there was indeed a departure in the care provided to Janet Olson over the course of her treatment experiences with Dr. Bishop.
But did the case need to be dismissed because of that?
Plaintiffs refused to comply.
My next question is going to be exactly how often does this come up? Because your brief certainly communicates a tale of woe with the way the case was prosecuted. But a lot of it is not really on the issue of non-compliance with the borrower. It's other stuff.
So,
exactly what, at what points in the litigation did they exhibit willful and contumacious behavior in terms of the bar order?
Sure. And that's a very valid point. And I guess
we'd start with 922.16 because that's when the first bar order.
Correct. And it's not just the bar order. Plaintiffs, in addition to the bar order, limited their complaint so that it was the allegations that existed in the 622 report that they had were completely limited to what occurred during the May 2013 surgery. That's it. They limited it on their own, and there was the barring order.
Which is well documented in the appeal.
Yes. From there, we had issues back and forth with respect to language included in the third amended complaint that didn't comport with the court's ruling. We finally got to a fourth amended complaint.
Is there an order? I'm not cross-examining. This is not a closed book test.
Yes, and it's also explicitly...
I think for our purposes, if you're asking us to affirm this stringent sanction, we need to clearly delineate. They violated it here, they violated it there, they violated this date, they violated that date, and they showed an unwillingness such that we should overlook your 201K obligation.
Every step of the way.
So back to my point, though, is, what are these dates where they exhibited behavior that supports a conclusion that this final straw was willful and contumacious such that dismissal was appropriate?
Every step of the way was a fight with plaintiff. Every step of the way. Here are the orders that will reference.
So the tale of woe.
Yes. So with respect to the third amended complaint, there were fights back and forth. It's actually addressed in the Second District's appellate court ruling from 2021. It is discussed in detail as to the proposed third amended complaint and how it continued into the fourth amended complaint, and that's discussed on pages 10, 11, and 12 of the appellate court ruling.
Is there paragraph number?
Yes, it goes from ...24 to paragraph 29. So first there was the debate about the amended pleading. Then, from there, we had Dr. Bishop's deposition was being taken, or was going to be taken, and pursuant to some discovery issues that were unrelated to what you're asking me about, we ended up in front of the trial court, and as a result of the issues that were being presented and as a result of plaintiff trying to essentially get additional discovery related to the 2011 surgery and care and treatment by providers in the office that preceded the May 15, 2013 surgery, I requested from the court that we have some type of limiting instruction with respect to Dr. Bishop's deposition, because I foresaw plaintiff's counsel spending an absurd amount of time at his deposition covering 2011, and I wanted to limit it. So the court provided a limiting instruction in the November 2, 2017 order. And from there, we proceeded with Dr. Bishop's deposition, where plaintiffs spent over 60 pages out of 215 pages were spent on care and treatment from 2011 surgery. Just 2011 surgery, not even including the remainder.
And in what way did that violate anything?
They essentially were trying to establish that this, in my opinion, structural deformity was not corrected at any point in time with the 2011.
Well, if it wasn't corrected in 2011.
And 2013.
Then in 2013, it's still going to be a problem. And just from their point of view, may still establish negligence on the part of the doctor. So it's certainly relevant to that 2013 claim, isn't it? How do we fault them in an appellate court opinion and say it bothered the defense attorney to talk about 2011 and they shouldn't have spent 60 pages at the dep?
The deposition itself reads full of objections between myself and Mr. Karamanis. And I can say to your honor that, again, the structural deformity that's present during the May 15, 2013 surgery is allowed. But a structural deformity prior to what occurred during the May 15, 2013 surgery is not permissible.
Aren't they limited simply to saying it failed once, so the same procedure is going to fail again? Isn't that the...
I don't read the orders to include that. My review of the orders is that Plaintiff 622 report, which was one of the bases for the original 2016 barring order, Plaintiff 622 report limited the negligence to solely what occurred during the May 15, 2013 surgery. And therefore, even if there was a structural deformity present, and Judge Bowles addressed this specifically in the July 29, 2020 hearing, and there's a transcript of that in this, she addressed this specific issue. It's about the word choice. Did it fail because it was already there and fail? It's about how they word things. And she addressed this with her
I'm sorry, I had interrupted you or somehow you got off track. We were on the 213s at one point. I just wanted to make sure that we covered all of the 213s that you thought violated the order. So we had the...
We did not. So expert disclosures indicate that it was over the course of the treatment experiences. Dr. Harrell's report also says the same exact thing. It says actually something worse. Talks about her damages and then says this is the result of negligence that occurred during the course of the medical treatment. So negligence that occurred during the course, what course? We're limited to May 15, 2013. Plaintiff's expert disclosures themselves also said Dr. Harrell will discuss the choice of the initial, meaning the first surgery, it states initial, Austin bunionectomy with possible implant versus a fusion of the first metatarsal phalangeal joint, which would have better addressed the first metatarsal elevation deformity and hypermobility. So by saying that, they're indicating that his decision in the initial Austin bunionectomy to place the implants as opposed to a fusion was inappropriate because the fusion would have better addressed her issues and corrected this underlying deformity. Again, we're going back to the initial surgery. I don't understand that.
How does this prejudice you when it could have, couldn't that just have been stricken?
So every time this court entered orders, which 2016 we had a barring order, 2020 we had a barring order in July.
Just to be fair to the other side, before then, you know, that kind of brought to fruition, like, hey, wait a minute, there's a statute of limitations here, the defense is invoking it, and that September 2016 order, that's the beginning, that's the first barring order.
Yes.
So maybe they wanted to bring it up, they explored it, they were interested, they certainly, would have prosecuted that claim if they'd have been able to, but there's nothing contumacious about that.
At that time, no.
No.
At that time.
Exactly. So 9-22-16, that's the beginning. When after that did they exhibit willful behavior?
So Dr. Bishop's deposition.
With respect to the barring order.
So Dr. Bishop's deposition.
Is that mentioned in Judge Bowles' ruling?
So she stated in her ruling that at every case management conference, our case had to be called last because there were always issues concerning the scope of the 2016 barring order. Every time. There was motion practice related to this. In my January 2018 motion for a protective order after Dr. Bishop's step proceeded, I specifically told the court that plaintiff had not complied with the 2016 order or her 2017 order concerning limiting his deposition primarily to the 2013 surgery. She granted my motion for a protective order. That is how discovery worked during that time period. There were fights about this at every single case management conference.
It's hard as an appellate court to look back and say, oh, the length of hearing means one side for sure is to blame. But what I am, and I do appreciate you pointing out that protective order because I had forgotten about it. So there was the protective order of, let me make sure, 2-2018, I think?
She granted the motion on 2-2018, I believe.
Yes.
I think the protective order had been filed in January of 2018.
All right, but I mean, at
yes.
that point,
yes.
there was an instance where the trial court had said, hey, we weary of the discussion of 2011 when, although, you know, her ruling and orders were always careful to say negligence and damages.
Correct.
Not any mention.
Correct.
It's not like the lady was born on the 2013 surgery. There was a history here with
yeah.
the doctor that both the trial court judges were, that I reviewed their rulings acknowledged that was going to come in. Then after is 7-29-20 the next where the motion to strike and bar was granted?
No. The next issue that presented was when plaintiff was ordered to disclose their experts in 2019. They didn't do so until March of 2020. And when they did, they completely violated the 2016 order by their initial F3 disclosures, which included this new theory of continuous course of negligent treatment that had never been in the case, that included this.
Is that what, and I don't mean to interrupt you, but that's what led to the July 29, 2020 order?
In part, yes.
Mm-hmm.
After plaintiffs filed, again, that's where the starting point, I guess, is for plaintiff's first expert disclosure violated the 2016 order. Then they filed that motion to reconsider, which was improper because it raised this new legal theory that hadn't been pursued previously. And then
the appellate court, you know, previously took care of that, and I guess they had the right to, you know, bring this issue up, try and litigate it, and then take the appeal if they had the right to do that. The trial court gave them 304A language.
Respectfully, this was not zealous advocacy. This was an attempt by plaintiff first to not comply with the 2016 order with their disclosures. And then when they brought the motion to reconsider, they claimed in the motion to reconsider that no additional discovery would be necessary, so there would be no prejudice to defendants to the 13 witnesses we had deposed in the case over the course of the prior 4 years, to just let them amend their theory of the case to now include the 2011 allegations of negligence. And they raised this theory for the first time 4 years after the barring order in 2016, after F1 and F2 discovery was completed and 13 deaths went by. It was gamesmanship and an improper attempt to reinsert the allegations of the 2011 surgery or the allegations of negligence concerning that 2011 surgery back into the case. From there, the court then on July 29th, 2020, granted my motion to bar, to strike and bar, and denied plaintiff's motion to reconsider, which then she asked plaintiff to amend the disclosures, which plaintiff then sent over track changes that were redlined, and from there, the amended opinions didn't actually comport at all with either the 2016 order or the 2020 order.
But it's around that time that I think two things happened again. You know, you may know the record better than I. But in September 4, 2020, you or the defense, excuse me, brought a motion to bar for sanctions, which was denied. So if we were going to examine points at which, according to you, the plaintiff should have been red flagged, that, hey, you know, you're not to be including this stuff in your F3s, that might be something that should be on the list as a red flag to the plaintiff from the trial court that you weren't to do this. And then I have a note as to, and you might remember better than I, December 8, 2020. Was that the hearing on the motion to reconsider?
I'm not familiar with the December 8, 2020 date because at that point the case was on appeal. So what happened before was in September when the court had the motion for sanctions that I had filed since, and I attached that email where there was the 201K conference via the email in
August of 2020.
August of 2020. Yeah. I attached that to my September 4th, 2020 motion. And also before the court on September 9th was plaintiff's motion for a 304A language to be included so that they could appeal the July 29, 2020 order. So she ultimately addressed this issue at the time that we were before her in June of 2022, where she said plaintiff's expert disclosures did not comply in September of 2020 when she denied the motion for sanctions. She wasn't saying that they complied, but she wasn't sanctioning them because essentially there's 304A language and it's about to be taken up on appeal, and she's saying let's just move on with it because we're probably going to be going to the appellate court.
And I don't mean to interrupt. In paragraph 43 of the appellate opinion, it says, on December 8, 2020, the trial court heard argument. There's a long discussion about it.
I'm sorry, paragraph
43 of the appellate court opinion. On December 8, 2020, the trial court heard argument. It looks like, I could have this wrong.
This should say July 28th of 2020 because that's when she heard oral argument on the motion to strike and the motion to reconsider. And July 29th, the following day, is when the order was entered pursuant to that July 28th, 2020 hearing. So the December 8th is a typo.
In the appellate court?
In the appellate court ruling.
So let me get to my point, and then I'll double back without officially acknowledging that there could be a typo in the appellate court opinion. I'm going to skip that. But I have a note. It says, at that hearing, whatever date it was, the trial court saying everybody understands that some of the prior treatment is relevant, but negligence and damages are out. So that might be, whatever that hearing date is, and you say it's when?
Assuming we're talking about the same hearing, the July 28th, 2020 hearing is when she heard my motion to strike and bar and granted it, and also denied, she considered it, but she denied plaintiff's motion for reconsideration.
Well, let me just make a note of that. So you say it's July 2020.
July 28th was the actual hearing. July 29th was the order entered relative to the hearing.
And then was there anything?
October was when I believe plaintiff filed their notice of appeal before the appellate court in 2020.
All right, and then I think we could say, if we're trying to develop a list of points at which it should have become clear that the court was speaking to the plaintiff saying, we don't want this as part of your allegations of negligence, we probably could add the appellate opinion.
Yes, absolutely.
Which was issued October of 2021.
Correct. And from there,
anything else that you would point to other than?
Yes.
Or just alluding to the general course of what you view as hyper-aggressive litigation.
I will just tell you there's many more paragraphs in the expert disclosures that plaintiff ultimately filed in February of 2022 that contain inappropriate, the third set of amended expert disclosures that ultimately resulted in my motion to dismiss as a sanction to plaintiff, which the court did not grant.
But I'm only looking at the trial court signaling, not them doing something. Do you follow me? See the difference?
I see what you're saying. Yes. So that's
because it's in response to the trial court, the failure to recognize the trial court's authority.
I mean,
that's what makes contempt.
What I can say to you is that I was present at every single hearing. I have been with this case since the original filing of it in Cook County before we transferred it to Kane. I have litigated this matter on behalf of my clients from the get-go. And what I can tell you is that at every CMC, including after the appellate court ruled, it was a discussion before the court relative to, okay, plaintiffs, that's out. We have now addressed this with the appellate court. I mean, I can't cite to you a transcript of proceedings because one doesn't exist, but that is what occurred at these case management conferences. Everyone should have been on the same page. I can't fathom why after 2016, 2020, and now a 2021 Second District Appellate Court decision, how we ever received the amended disclosures that we received in February of 2022 from plaintiff, which I detailed in my brief ad nauseum. I'm happy to go over it again. But even the statement that plaintiff brings up, that plaintiff cites in plaintiff's expert report, as though it was clear that the expert was only criticizing the 2013 surgery, does not stand for the proposition that plaintiff argues. It's on the last page of Dr. Harrell's report, where Dr. Harrell states, Dr. Paul Bishop's medical negligence directly caused permanent injuries to Ms. Olson during her 2013 surgery. He doesn't specify when the medical negligence occurs in that sentence that plaintiff has recited because it includes this 2013 surgery. All he's saying is that the injury occurred at the time of the 2013 surgery. But if you turn to the prior page, all over this prior page, it's related that this is the damages are a result of negligence that occurred during the course of medical treatment. Ms. Olson's foot pain is permanent and related to the negligence of Dr. Bishop during her original surgery and subsequent treatment. And when Your Honors asked Mr. Caramanis, plaintiff's counsel, what could have been done instead of dismissing the case, he said she could have enforced the order. Well, isn't that what the trial court attempted to do for years? I don't understand that argument. And to that end, I will say, plaintiff, in their briefs, still indicate that there has been no violation of any court order. That's what the position has been. No violation.
They made certain comments that 2011 is not mentioned, first surgery is not mentioned. They use very almost conclusory terms that don't relate to any point in time.
In some of the statements, but in others where you have, this is related to the negligence of Dr. Bishop during her original surgery. The pleading that plaintiffs have on file, and I cite this in my brief as well, plaintiffs literally define the first surgery, they put that in there, on such and such date, on November 30th of 2011, plaintiff underwent the first surgery with Dr. Bishop, an Austin bunionectomy. Yes. They put in their complaint, on May 15, 2013, plaintiff underwent the second surgery with Dr. Bishop.
That was in the first one. And then Goldman had it sort of.
That's still in the operative complaint, that the first procedure occurred in 2011, the second procedure occurred in 2013. It was never my intention, nor was it the court.
Well, this order relates to the F3 disclosures, right?
Yeah. Because ultimately, at the end of the day.
Not the complaint.
Well, at the end of the day, the F3 disclosure, not just the F3 disclosure that plaintiff's counsel prepared, but even after they say they told their expert 2011 is out, the expert still includes it all over the report. And there's specific statements about the continuous course of care and treatment in which negligence occurred. There's specific statements concerning related to the negligence of Dr. Bishop during her original surgery. Ms. Olson's poor surgical outcome is the direct result of several factors that resulted in her failure of the implant twice. This includes, and that's where they go to say that a fusion should have been done rather than the initial bunionectomy. The bottom line is it didn't comply with the court's orders, and they couldn't even comply as far as an expert disclosure was concerned, and can't even say that the disclosure had typos or apologize to the trial court and offer to amend to the trial court their expert disclosures. The only conclusion left to draw is that this misconduct is going to continue. Plaintiffs are not going to comply. And that is ultimately where Judge Bowles found herself. She did. She absolutely considered the factors that are announced in Szymanowski. I'm killing the pronunciation. I apologize. She did. She went through them. She discussed the prejudice to defendants. It was all over the briefs that she read. She discussed the prejudice to defendants of having to proceed with this case where trial of this matter is going to occur probably closer to 15 years after the original surgery at issue. We're already at almost 12 years from the original, from the 2013 surgery. We are a decade into this lawsuit, and we don't have proper expert disclosures.
Rather than just tossing the Dr. Harrell, couldn't there, and maybe this is the point that they were trying to make, sitting down at a table and saying, okay, this is what we want crossed out in Dr. Harrell's report, and if they agreed, they agreed. If they didn't agree, they didn't agree, but that never happened.
Respectfully, I've had so many 201K conferences with plaintiff's counsel, and it never changed a thing. We were continuously arguing about the exact scope of the 2016 order. Plaintiffs were continuously not complying with that order, then the 2020 order, and now the appellate court's 2021 order. And a 201K conference, how would that have, I can't see how that would have made a difference when ultimately the arguments the plaintiff raised to the trial court in their response brief and at the hearing was that defendants literally manufactured and fabricated allegations and mischaracterized the expert report and expert disclosures.
Well, but even so, counsel, I mean, you could have the most contentious litigation in the world where every prior attempt has failed. You just send an email saying, if I don't hear from you by tomorrow, I will consider this my attempt to engage in a 201K conference. And isn't that enough? Then you've avoided this entire issue.
I don't, based on Hartnett versus Stack, and based on the trial court's assessment of this case, she felt that a 201K conference would be futile. And Hartnett specifically indicates if the conduct, the past conduct between the parties has shown that essentially a 201K conference would be futile and wouldn't serve any purpose, then essentially you can still proceed with sanctions without actually having had a 201K conference between the parties. I mean, even the 201K conference we had in 2020 didn't result in plaintiff's counsel sending over amended disclosures again that actually comported with what we had represented needed to be changed. It wasn't going to change anything, and plaintiffs continued in 2022 to take the position before the court that they didn't do anything wrong and that defendants were misreading and mischaracterizing plaintiff's expert disclosures and an expert report. And I need to comment, I apologize, I know I'm probably over time here, but I need to comment on just quickly a statement that plaintiff made. Plaintiff indicated that there was no problem with Dr. Goldman's disclosure, and that isn't a correct statement of what occurred. Plaintiff, essentially, when the case came back from the appellate court to the trial court, we were in front of Judge Bowles, and plaintiff contacted defense counsel and said, Dr. Goldman, his license is no longer going to be good by the end of this year. He's no longer going to be practicing. He's retiring. Can you take his discovery deposition and evidence deposition over the Christmas holidays, over New Year's, and then take his evidence deposition on a Saturday in January, less than 2 weeks later? We couldn't. Our schedules had been insane. We couldn't do it. There was nothing that could be done about that. Additionally, we had asked plaintiff to provide the doctor's report, what the doctor's opinions were actually going to be, any report he had authored. Plaintiffs had not produced that to us. So we may well, had this gone differently, we may well have been in front of the trial court on a motion relative to Dr. Goldman again before Dr. Harrell was produced. But it was really a non-issue, and I only raise that because plaintiff seems to indicate that somehow under the Szymanowski factor, defendant wasn't diligent in pursuing you know, plaintiff's non-compliance, I guess, with the court orders. But immediately upon getting plaintiff's amended disclosures, I, within 24 days, filed a 14-page motion. I don't think that that's untimely. And again, we were dealing with this issue. And the other thing plaintiff said that was not accurate, he claimed that the trial court only gave him, would only give him 28 days to disclose a new expert. That is not accurate. Plaintiff's counsel only asked the court for that period of time to disclose.
Well, that was for disclosure. It wasn't for the actual opinion.
Disclosure in 2022.
Of a name.
No, the actual opinions as well in 2022. But plaintiff was seeming to indicate that there was some limitation by the trial court relative to the amount of time. The court asked the plaintiff's counsel how much time he needed, and that's what he said.
What year, if you can just give me a ballpark, did this problem with Dr. Goldman come up where Christmas and New Year's were going to be at issue?
2021.
I know that 2021, but what year in the process? Oops. Sorry.
So
that's 10 years in?
That is,
since the litigation
they filed the issue surgery was 2013. The suit was filed in May of 2015.
Okay.
So December of 2021, you're
so 6 years. And all right.
But, we're almost at 7 because we were into 2022 with the new year that they wanted us to do
but
as well.
The point was, I think that this case has been out there. We've got to do something now. And you say your schedules were busy. Was it with this case or other cases?
We were not being ordered by the court to complete the depositions during that time period. Plaintiffs literally sprung this on us out of nowhere. We had no idea that their expert was going to suddenly be unavailable and wouldn't be able to come in to testify at trial. So we literally, I think they told us this in December, and we literally were trying to figure out dates that might work, but then they came in with this limiting request that we take the discovery deposition within 2 weeks of the evidence deposition. So, and we're looking, we could do Saturdays in January, that's what they were asking then, and basically, because we were out of town for the Christmas holidays and New Year's, it just wasn't possible.
Well, do you ever, and I'm not saying you personally, but is Saturday so outlandish a request?
Not at all.
You've done others on Saturday. You've done other things on Saturday that relate to cases, correct?
Of course.
Okay.
Of course. But at the end of the day, the issue is not about Dr. Goldman. The issue is about Dr. Harrell's disclosure in 2022.
Well, it might not have been if we could have resolved Dr. Goldman during that period.
I suspect, based on the conduct that occurred at Dr. Bishop's deposition and the witnesses from Centers for Foot and Ankle and the way that things had gone throughout the entire course of the case, that if Dr. Goldman had testified, or even Dr. Harrell, we would have had the same issues presented. Plaintiffs at every turn have tried to reinsert these allegations or preserve these issues. I don't know what they're preserving. I don't know why they won't let this go. They have stubbornly and consciously chose to do that and not obey the court's orders.
Okay. Justice Kennedy, any questions?
I do have one. Concerning the attorney's fees, does your affidavit or did your affidavit break out the time spent by which attorney on what tasks, and did it need to comply with the applicable law? So two questions.
My affidavit did not do that. My affidavit, also filed with another attorney at my firm, Steve Heil, provided the number of hours that we had spent working on the motion for sanctions, the hearings, et cetera, that had proceeded, and the amount of money. It is within the court's discretion as to what to award as far as reasonable attorneys under Rule 219.
I haven't gotten to that, but there are, is it required of you
no.
to say, here's which attorney did what, on what task and how long did it take him? I mean, so let me just call that an itemized bill.
All the judge requested from us when she asked us to submit our petition for attorney fees was for an affidavit to be included, and we provided that affidavit. And
did the law require any more?
No.
Did the law require
anything? The law did not require anything more. The plaintiff's attorneys, the case law that plaintiff's attorney is citing to does not involve a discovery sanction. The case law plaintiff cites to for this proposition all involve attorney fees for their client that the attorneys have not been able to get from the client. And the court in that scenario requires an itemization and so forth. But in the scenario that we were presented with here, that was not the case because it was pursuant to 219, the Illinois Supreme Court Rule 219. And so consequently, we provided an affidavit that expressed the exact number of hours that we had billed and the total amount that we had charged and been paid. And actually, the court lowered the figure that we had submitted. So she felt that what was fair and reasonable under those circumstances was the $7,000. I also will just say, the court did not dismiss this case as a sanction. She did not grant my motion to dismiss. She instead issued a barring order that dealt with the exact discovery violation that occurred over and over again. The summary judgment motion that was ultimately brought, the trial court would have had no way of knowing whether plaintiff had any F2 witness that could step up to provide standard of care opinions. She did not preclude that from occurring, but plaintiff did not, in fact, have that F2 witness to testify in this case as to the standard of care for my client. So that's why ultimately the summary judgment motion was granted. It was unchallenged by anything that plaintiff added.
All right. If you would please summarize and come to a your recommendation to this court.
Yeah, thank you. At the end of the day, we have multiple instances of noncompliance. We have a trial court who literally spent an enormous amount of time with counsel going over all of these things, making everything crystal clear. We have repeated noncompliance by plaintiff's counsel, and up until today, plaintiff's counsel never even addressed the fact that the expert disclosures indicated any damages occurring prior to May 15, 2013. They never addressed the fact that the expert disclosures and expert report included a continuous course of negligent treatment that had been barred by this court in addition to the trial court. They never provided any explanation for any of that until today, where they said that the continuous course of treatment was inadvertent. That wasn't in the briefs. It wasn't before the trial court. That was never said. There's a reason that the standard of review is an abuse of discretion, and that great deference is given to the trial court with respect to the trial court's rulings, and that's because the trial court is intimately familiar with what has occurred over the course of the case history. Ultimately, an abuse of discretion occurs when no reasonable person could take the view adopted by the trial court, and I would argue that there are plenty of reasonable people that could take the view of the trial court with respect to her rulings here, and I would ask your honors to affirm her rulings in this matter. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Mr.
Hello again.
So you're going to argue the rebuttal, although I have Mr. Nazari doing it. That's fine.
Yeah, we'll give him a break. Give him a break for the rest of the day. You did an admirable job. So just to, Your Honor Mullen, you had asked for the timeline. In early December of 2021 is when we learned Dr. Goldman would not be able to continue to participate as an expert. Essentially, on January 27th of 2022, we informed the trial court that Dr. Goldman was no longer able to serve as the plaintiff's expert. And then we disclosed Dr. Harrell's opinions on February 28th, 2022.
Counsel, on that point, Dr. Harrell, in his report, so in the 213s, and, you know, counsel for the defense has pointed out, some language we can maybe quibble over the use of the plural with regard to procedures, treatment experiences, another arthroplasty, subsequent decision. Those may or may not be violative. But how does the paragraph number two not directly violate the court's order in saying Dr. Harrell will discuss the choice of the initial Austin bunionectomy with possible implant versus fusion of the first metatarsal phalangeal joint, which would have better addressed the first elevation deformity and hypermobility, combined with the statement in the expert's report from February 28, 22, that it is my opinion within a reasonable degree of medical certainty that Ms. Olson's foot pain is permanent and related to the negligence of Dr. Bishop during her original surgery and subsequent treatment. How are those two statements not directly in violation of the court's orders?
Dr. Harrell prepared a report. His report is not our disclosure.
All right, so let's set that aside. In the 213s, you listed the choice of the initial.
Correct. It's what he was, he would, that's a factual analysis that Dr. Harrell was going to address, the choice, why he chose that particular item. He's not, he, we did not say there that that choice was a negligent choice or was a, only that he was going to discuss that choice. Now remember, counsel just minutes ago said she was going to go into the first surgery about that choice with the plaintiff and why she did not choose a fusion. So that's a fact of the first surgery. So,
and nonetheless, you're discussing the choice during the about of the first surgery.
Correct. That is a factual why that was chosen. And counsel herself said she was going to talk about that same choice as opposed to the fusion. And that's what could have easily been clarified in the 201K conference.
Well, but she's going to say that, at least what she offered here, was that Mrs. Olson said, no, I don't want that to happen.
She said she didn't want the fusion.
Right.
Correct.
So that's a fact. That's over. It's not
correct.
Negligent. She can't be negligent because she doesn't, you know, that's, she's not capable of that.
Correct.
It's her foot. She wants to do it that way. She wants to do it that way. So that does not involve negligence at that point. It doesn't even involve a conversation about negligence.
Correct. And that's not what paragraph 2 addresses. It doesn't address, paragraph 2 does not address a negligent choice. It's just going to discuss the choice.
But it ultimately is followed, and I don't have the page open anymore, by this course of conduct or course, continuing course of negligence.
So
it's got to start somewhere.
Well, perhaps it was a, you know, an inappropriate term to use, but the course, meaning the course during the second surgery. It doesn't mean the course during both surgeries. We were barred from that.
But you it could have said, this shows a negligent conduct in engaging in the 2013 surgery or in completing the 2013 surgery, but it doesn't say that.
You say that in paragraph 5.
Okay, but then get rid of paragraph 2. You could have done that. You didn't.
Well, we didn't because there was no 201K conference to discuss that issue. There was just a motion to bar, and we were before the judge, and Mr. Nazarian indicated, and he told the judge, but there was no 201K conference where we could have resolved these issues. That's the whole point of 201K, is to resolve issues like this. I'm not trying to backdoor in.
But you're talking to her, you're talking to counsel as you talk to the judge. At least I'm assuming counsel was listening while you were talking to the judge, and you were listening while counsel was talking to the judge. So you knew what the issue was.
At that point, there was the motion to bar, okay? So could we have done things better? Could we have said, can we revise these to make sure there's no ambiguity? Perhaps that was a better course of action. That still does not justify throwing the whole case out because of ambiguous language.
Can I just...
Yes.
At what point was there a motion to bar? Like this, as I understand it, this These are your final F3s.
Correct.
Which I've lost track of exactly when.
That was February 28th of 2022.
Yes, thank you. There was a motion to bar previous to that, but that had been denied, what, September 4, 2020? And then there was the appellate opinion.
Correct. So, but there was no...
There had been a motion to bar. Is there one pending at the time when you released Dr.?
No, no.
All right.
There was no motion pending. And counsel kept referring to our disclosures as amended disclosures. These are new disclosures from a new expert. These aren't amended from the previous expert. So essentially, if there is ambiguous language here, and you know, I think what Mr. Nazarian conceded is not a new disclosure that there was a continuous, we're saying there was a continuous course. He's saying that we agree that some of the language was perhaps ambiguous. But that's, again, the whole purpose of 201K. And I'd like to, counsel cited to the Hartnett case, but in that case, defendant simply did not respond to interrogatories and requests for document production. They showed an unwillingness to cooperate in scheduling the defendant's deposition. You know, that's not the case here. You know, we didn't like some of the rulings of the court, obviously, because we tried to preserve an issue for appeal and brought up an appeal. And we accept it. But to say that, for counsel to stand here and to say that I wasn't zealously representing my client but deliberately not complying is just false. It's just absolutely false. I mean, we prosecute a case, we represent our clients, we do the best that we can for our clients. And that's what we were doing. And we're not, and these disclosures, you can see, we found a substitute expert. Case has been going on for a while. We found a substitute expert in a relatively short amount of time and worked feverishly to get his disclosures in. We did not include everything in his report because of the barring order. But this physician, Dr. Harrell, didn't know it. So there's a couple other points I'd like to bring out from counsel's argument, which I think are also just incorrect. To say that at every CMC conference there was a dispute about discovery is just patently false. I mean, it's just not true. And when counsel indicated that my response to what the judge could have done differently, when I said she could have enforced the order, we weren't necessarily saying to enforce the order with respect to Dr. Harrell's opinion. So the order was in place. Those opinions were barred. So if we had attempted, what I think I said is that if we were at trial, and any type of evidence was sought to be introduced with respect to the 2011 surgery, she would enforce the order, saying this has been previously barred, you know, objection sustained, right? Which we would have tried to do. So that's when I said enforce the order. That's what I'm talking about. But could easily have been resolved.
But short of the judge taking her red pen, and I'm assuming she has one somewhere, and crossing out things and saying, okay, this is what you got, we're going with this. It's not her job to do that.
Right, and I don't necessarily disagree, but if you look at our disclosures, again, the bulk of these disclosures relate to the 2013. Any reference to 2011 was meant as a factual inquiry, because as counsel indicated herself, she was going to go into the facts of the 2011 case. So to say that I was somehow in Dr. Bishop's deposition being contumacious because I was asking about the 2011 surgery, I had a conversation with counsel prior to that deposition. If she did not go into the 2011 surgery, I wouldn't either. She said, no, I'm going to go into her choice. So I have a duty, if she's going to use that as a defense, that the plaintiff chose not to do a fusion, then I have a duty to go into the facts surrounding Dr. Bishop's decisions and the circumstances.
Well, there were two options. Maybe one was better than the other. Okay, let's just, from my listening and reading here for this case, okay. Two options. One might have been better, but she chose the one that ultimately maybe wasn't better. But she can't commit negligence. The doctor says, okay, I'll make it work. that's not, you know, that's not discussing negligence. That's discussing what happened.
Exactly. And that's our goal.
But you then put it in terms of continuing course of negligence during her treatment. Now, with Dr. Bishop isn't in there, but that's implied.
But not in these disclosures of Dr. Harrell. We don't put, we're not saying his continuous course of treatment was negligent. Right. We're saying in the course of the treatment, I think in the first paragraph he says, over the course of her treatment experience with Dr. Paul Bishop, that perhaps is a little ambiguous, but that relates to the 2013 surgery. Because it wasn't just, it doesn't say that, but we were already limited to the 2013 surgery.
But that doesn't mean that.
So do we have to explicitly say this paragraph relates only to the 2013 surgery? So for every paragraph, do we have to put that out? Because we already had a Barton order, so we were just providing the opinions. And you can see the differences between his report and our disclosures. We did call out that reference to continuous course of treatment. So, and I think, again, this could easily have been resolved in the 201K. If you look at all the cases with respect to, you know, whether a 201K conference would have been fruitful, we had 201K conferences. Sure, we had disagreements, but we had 201K conferences. I made some concessions, counsel made some concessions, and we were able to move on. We didn't necessarily agree on everything, but that's the whole point of the 201K. So,
can I ask you this?
Yes.
You know, you said, well, we would have had a motion in limine, and we would have solved it at trial. And I guess my question is, doesn't the whole 213 framework require you to disclose down to specifics the underpinnings of the expert's opinions, I should say, such that a deposition might not be required? I mean, you know, you've also said, well, a deposition could have gone into it, but 213 doesn't require everybody to take a dep. In fact, it's my opinion that the
disclosures were insufficient. And I would again point...
Well, no, that's why I added.
Right.
One, 213, but two, the bar order.
Right, the bar
so
order.
So that was part of the framework here. Part of what you were stuck with your 213 disclosures.
Correct. Well, I can, with the 213, like in paragraph 5, for example, we specifically say breach the standard of care during the 2013 surgery. That's specific to that, to the surgery. And we also say that in, with respect to the subsequent decision to, of implant removal and replacement, that's a subsequent decision. That's obviously related to the 2013 surgery. So, could they have been more detailed and specific? I have no, I'm not disputing, especially because we're here. Obviously, it could have been more detailed and specific. But in the context of the court's barring order, you know, the disclosures, obviously, in our view, relate to the 2013 surgery. So it's the other side of the coin. So these disclosures were made with the concept that there was a barring order in place for the 2011 surgery. So in our view, obviously, none of these are meant to go to the 2011 surgery. Why would we do that? There was no problem with Dr. Goldman's deposition. And then, and Your Honor, with respect to the questions regarding Dr. Goldman's deposition, I remember this. I was feverently trying to get this scheduled. And while there were counsel related, may have been vacations over the holidays, there was no vacations in January. And we tried to get this set up in January. And the evidence deposition would have been taken by us because he's our witness. Okay, so the discovery deposition would have been taken by them. They proposed several different dates to try and get this resolved. There was nothing in between those two dates that after the appellate court decision that the disclosures of Dr. Goldman.
We can't say that without looking at calendars, and there's just no time to talk
about it. I understand that, but
and
I'm just,
so if
counsel brought it up, so I just thought
if you would summarize and conclude.
Okay, so essentially, there were not multiple issues of noncompliance. There were issues of us representing our clients to the best of our ability. Defendants essentially contort the facts of this case to support a narrative that simply does not exist in reality. We, if you look at all the cases cited with respect to these types of sanctions, they're like not producing documents, they're not showing up for depositions, they're not, you know, the parties disappear. We were involved in this case from the beginning, and essentially, it was a surprising order nonetheless. So essentially, you know, based on, I'm sure you've heard enough, but based on everything that you've read, we believe that the lower court's decision should be overturned and the sanction order vacated, and that we'd like to go and proceed to trial. So essentially, that's where we're at. Thank you for your time and patience.
All right, thank you both today for waiting for us, and thank you for your arguments. We will take the matter under advisement. We are now going to stand, I believe, adjourned for the day, unless we have administrative matters to deal with.